This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. A recent report from the CDC estimates that 1 in 68 children fall somewhere on the autism spectrum. That's a 30% increase from the year 2012. Why this sudden increase? For starters, advancements in science have made autism spectrum disorder easier to recognize and diagnose, but some research also suggests that autism itself may be on the rise. This morning, local and national autism experts join us to talk about the meaning behind these trends. We'll also look at disparities in diagnosis and see what's being done to improve autism services in our state. We would like you to join this conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Email where we live at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at where we live. If you have questions about autism spectrum disorder, we'd love to try and answer them for you here. Our guests in studio are Dr. John Malteni, who's director of the Institute for Autism and Behavioral Studies at the University of St. Joseph. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Laura Saunders is a psychologist at the Institute of Living. Doctor, thank you so much for being here as well.
Thank you, John.
I'm wondering if I can start with you, Laura Saunders, and just ask about this study. When the CDC says 1 in 68 kids has autism spectrum disorder, just a few years ago when we heard the number 1 in 100, it shocked a lot of us. And many of us thought, my goodness, that seems like an enormous rise. It's really something we should be taking seriously. 2 years later, that number has gotten a lot worse. What happened?
Well, I think it's always good to distinguish the difference between diagnosis and prevalence. That over the years, we've really gotten much better with diagnosing autism spectrum disorders. And the reason we're saying autism spectrum disorders is because there has really been a change in the nomenclature, most recently with the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. So we're not looking at separate disorders anymore. We're looking at a spectrum disorder, which I think is the way a lot of people that work with individuals on the autism spectrum have seen it for a long time. So we're really looking at increases in prevalence, but we're also looking at much better improved diagnosis as well.
When you talk about the nomenclature changing around the spectrum, maybe you can explain exactly what you're talking about. I mean, has the spectrum itself gotten broader, wider, deeper, however you measure the spectrum?
Well, I think it's important to talk about the areas and deficits. So to make it simple, I look at three different areas for deficits for autism spectrum: socialization, communication, and behavior. So if you look at it in those three areas, socialization, communication, and behavior, and you're looking at ranges of deficits in each of those areas. So if you talk about someone who is high functioning, what we used to call Asperger's, those individuals may not have as many deficits in communication. They may have higher IQ levels. They may not have some of the behavioral markers we see in more significant and severe autism, but they certainly have some of the socialization deficits and miscues in social interactions, as well as some communication deficits. So I really like to keep coming back to those three areas for the general public to really understand where the deficits are that we're talking about.
Are these deficits that have long existed in society and we're just now coming to terms with calling them something on the autism spectrum, or indeed are we finding more things that we can really label as a true deficit, something that we should make sure that someone has some very specific treatment for?
Well, I would say, you know, if you think back to when, you know, some of us were in high school 20, 30 years ago, you know, we always knew that there was those kids that were odd or different or had real difficulty fitting in socially. We've seen these kids for a very, very long time. However, we've gotten better about, you know, diagnosing them. Because if you think about the kid 30 years ago that really did not fit in high school and, you know, couldn't seem to make friends, seemed to kind of get teased and picked on, that individual suffered. That individual suffered from being not having the skills to get along with other kids and kind of becoming a social outcast. And that, you know, I think the reason we want to talk about this, and I know we'll talk a lot about intervention and early intervention, is because the more and the earlier we can intervene with individuals who have severe deficits in these areas, the earlier we can intervene, the better the long-term outcome, and the more we decrease suffering.
We're talking today about autism on the program and a new CDC study that shows that one in 68 children in the U.S. fall somewhere on the autism spectrum. It's a big increase from the year 2012. We're trying to figure out why and talk a little bit about intervention, talk about services here in the state. We'd like to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. If autism has touched your life in some way, you can also email us where we live at WNPR.org or tweet us at where we live. Dr. John Maltenny, before we move into some of the topics we want to talk about, I'd like to get your take on this. What do you take away from these new statistics?
Well, these statistics really come out of essentially these are several years ago, actually, is what they're coming, what they're reporting on. So, you know, what we are seeing is really a greatly improved ability to diagnose autism spectrum disorders. And just to refer back to Dr. Saunders' point, you know, looking at functional impairments, when you talk about what are these social deficits and these behaviors, it's really when it rises to the level where it impairs the ability of the individual to function in their everyday life. That's when it leads to diagnosis. So I think it's, you know, there are, you know, awkward and odd people who do pretty well in their everyday life. And then there are those that are significant inability or difficulty with, you know, functioning in a school setting or in a workplace or in the types of community settings where we expect them to be able to function. So as we look at, you know, diagnosis, we are much more, we have much more awareness of it. So people are starting to look for it more. As in many cases, you see people trying to find it where it doesn't exist. But I think when we look at the work currently in terms of diagnosis, you know, we are seeing a much higher prevalence of autism, and we're just getting really good at saying this is where it falls along the spectrum and when it falls to a level of functional impairment that needs intervention.
I'm wondering if you can both pick up on this idea, though, of people trying to find it where it isn't. I mean, what do you mean by that, and how do you know that when you see it?
Well, sometimes we have individuals who, as Dr. Saunders was pointing out, in high school who are experiencing some social difficulties, and the default might be, well, let's see if it's autism. And so at the work I do at the Hospital for Special Care, where I direct autism services, we do a lot of evaluations, and we're seeing a lot of kids at middle school and high school, and they're coming in for this question, and we're actually, some are being diagnosed and some are not, and we have to sort of split hairs a little bit and say, this is an important social difficulty that you're having, but it's more related to, let's say, anxiety or social anxiety or a lack of social ability that can be addressed in different ways, but it's not necessarily, doesn't rise to the level of an autism spectrum disorder.
Dr. Saunders, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the important point that Dr. Maltenny's making is that as you move up the developmental spectrum, the social demands are greater and greater. So in elementary school, you're generally in more contained environments with kids that you will go to school with for long periods of time, for years on end. So those kids that have significant social deficits or really communication difficulties may get sort of just filled into the mix. It's when you hit that middle school time, and I know Dr. Maltenny agrees with this, that's where the social demands are so great and these kids really fall off that developmental chart. And anxiety does become an issue, but there are some core deficits in communication and socialization that make it very difficult for them to function. And that's, you know, the guideline that we use in any of these situations is how do your behaviors impair your functioning? Are you able to function in all areas of your life? We have some very successful people in this world who have autism spectrum or on the autism spectrum and can function. But it's when those individuals fall off that developmental spectrum and it really hinders their functioning, that's where we need to talk about intervention.
Given that the diagnosis maybe doesn't become easier but becomes more clear later in life as you are exposed to different social situations, how do you begin diagnosing people on the autism spectrum as young as the age of two? You talk about early intervention. Explain that a little bit for us, if you would.
The diagnostically, when you're looking, it's a little bit easier for those individuals who demonstrate pretty significant impairments in communication, social interaction, and repetitive patterns of behavior is the other area that we sort of haven't been speaking as much about. And for a youngster with pretty delayed onset of speech or a very delayed social interaction, making eye contact, responding to their name, engaging in sort of cuddly, cute behaviors that, you know, infants tend to do, we were able to do that. What's interesting about the most recent CDC numbers is that even though we can fairly reliably diagnose at age two, we're not diagnosing until age four. So we're still at a very late stage diagnosing kids, so we're missing a lot of kids for early intervention. And that's particularly true for the number of children who do not have an intellectual disability. We are seeing the precocious child who is, you know, spelling words with their refrigerator magnets at two, and they're very cute and they're talking, and we don't necessarily identify those kids as having an autism spectrum disorder.
And I think we see in these statistics that the children with an IQ over 85 tend to be diagnosed more readily, more often, according to these new statistics.
Yes, they're also, those are the group that are diagnosed a little bit later. So what Dr. Molteni is referring to is the earlier we can intervene, the better. But the kids that you can see at 2, 3, 4, and 5 are the individuals with the more severe behavioral, what we call the repetitive behaviors. They have a lot of gaze issues. They can't look at you. They can't follow a line of conversation. There's a lot more significant and severe deficits.
So what's the thing that you, if you can intervene between 2 and 4 at that earlier stage, what exactly do you do? How does it help? How much of an impact does it have?
Mm-hmm. Generally, the sort of recommended treatment is a very intensive early intervention, which generally follows the principles of applied behavior analysis. And those are the things that are identified both through Connecticut Birth to Three in their autism-specific programs, where they have a much higher level of support for children around up to 20 hours per week. And then in addition to that, you would want to look at things like speech therapy and early educational intervention, in many cases occupational therapy.
Why does it seem that so many more boys have autism than girls?
There's a lot of different theories on that. I mean, I just read an article the other day from it's the Journal of Molecular Psychiatry that talks about hormone links in cases of boys with autism. So looking at hormone levels in boys diagnosed with autism, you know, sensitivity around some of the some hormones. So I don't know that we have a lot of very clear understanding, but we do know that the rates of autism diagnosed in boys versus girls is almost double.
When you say hormones, an awful lot of people in our audience will say, aha, that points to one of these environmental factors that we need to take a closer look at. You talk about 20 or 30 years ago when all of us were in high school and we saw some things, but the world has changed in terms of what we eat, what we're exposed to, the diagnosis and everything else. I'm sure we will in a moment get some phone calls about this, when people say, well, there's something that my child's eating that I didn't eat, maybe that has something to do with his hormone levels. What do you say?
I mean, I don't know that we have we don't have anything definite at this point. When we talk about, the article is talking about prenatal levels of testosterone, progesterone, cortisol are greater on average than boys who were later diagnosed with autism. So, cortisol is a stress hormone. So does that mean, so there's a lot of subtlety in how we're doing these things. Does that mean that all pregnant mothers now, need to not work and sit back and relax? I don't know that we can necessarily prescribe that, although it probably would be better for many women if we did a lot more around, care. But the importance here is as we look to fund research, I think it's going to be, if we're talking about prevalence and the explosion in prevalence, we do want to start to look more in the research area around not just early diagnosis and intervention, but, what is it, what are the gene markers, what are the things that may be showing this incredible increase in prevalence?
I'd love for you to add to this if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, gene-environment interactions are fairly common and attempted to be understood in most disorders. And so, we're working very hard on looking at the genetics and looking very hard at the environmental impact that may be contributing to this. So I think when you hear on a fairly consistent basis, we're hearing different things on a weekly, monthly basis, where you'll hear, older fathers have contributed to this in some way. We have to be careful too and also say these are our single studies and they need replication over time. What we have been able to or what researchers have been able to do over the past several years is really answer the question around vaccines and mercury in vaccines and really not replicate the findings of Andrew Wakefield and some of the things that we saw early on. And that's really one of those things that we can relatively with good comfort because the science says so, this is not something that we should be concerned about, and we should be vaccinating our children.
Well, let me just – I'll get this phone call from Rachel in here, and you can join us at 860-275-7266. Rachel's in Guilford. Hi. I'm sorry. I apologize. It's Rebecca in Guilford. Thank you for your phone call.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I think one of your experts just partially answered my question, but I am a mother of a two-year-old and the wife of a pediatric nurse practitioner who believes very strongly in the regular vaccine schedule. We have, of course, vaccinated our child. And I'm just wondering what you would say to a parent who is either pregnant or has a young child and is on the fence about whether or not to vaccinate.
Thank you very much for your phone call, Rebecca.
That's a great question. You know, I'm a PhD, so I always say I'm not a real doctor. But what I do say is that the general medical consensus is that you do follow your general vaccination schedule, and that is not something that, you know, that I would avoid at any cost.
Dr. Saunders, I'm just wondering if you can expand on this, because as we go through a program like this, that is one of the issues that comes up over and over again. There have been a number of studies about this. Many people in your field say, stay in the vaccination schedule. We don't have any link between that and autism. But what else do you tell people who come up to you and ask those questions?
Well, this is the time where you have that conversation with your pediatrician. You have that conversation in your, you know, in your pediatrician's office with the pediatrician or the nurse practitioner to talk about, these are my concerns. And, you know, I read something on the internet. The sad part is you can find confirmation for whatever your wacky theory is on the internet somewhere. But you need to have these personal conversations, because as a parent, you know, it's easy to say, well, the, you know, American Pediatric Society still recommends staying on the vaccination schedule. But that may not reassure you. Have a personal conversation with your pediatrician. Ask them specific questions about what you're concerned about. The issue is the thermosol. That's, I mean, it's a mercury-based that they, you know, that ask questions, have that conversation so that you do feel better. But the sad thing is one study that really used some very, you know, bad methodology and may have fabricated results has really thrown a lot of people off.
We're talking today with Dr. Laura Saunders, who's a psychologist at the Institute of Living, and Dr. John Maltenny, who's director of the Institute for Autism and Behavioral Studies at the University of St. Joseph. We're talking about autism spectrum disorders after a rise in the numbers of kids diagnosed with autism in a recent CDC study. When we come back, we're going to take some more of your phone calls. We're going to be talking about disparities in care for those with autism. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're talking about autism spectrum disorder, taking a look at some of the results of a new CDC study that shows 1 in 68 children in America is diagnosed on the autism spectrum. That's a big jump over the last study that we saw back in 2012. What does all this mean? Just better diagnosis? Does it actually mean more prevalence of autism? We're taking your calls and questions at 860-275-7266. Let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Hartford. Hello, Jennifer. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on in Connecticut around autism. I really appreciate you having the show. I'm the director of the Autism Division at the Department of Developmental Services, and we're one of the few states in the country that has a division specifically to look at the issues and services and all of the information surrounding autism spectrum disorder, and that's because we have support from Governor Malloy as well as Commissioner Macy of the Department of Developmental Services, excuse me. One of the things that we do in the division is we have an Autism Spectrum Disorders Advisory Council, and the council meets quarterly at the Legislative Office Building and is open to the public, and actually Dr. Maltenny, one of your panelists, is on that council. And I would just really encourage people to think about participating and coming and giving public comment and talking about your issues. We have several subcommittees that are doing a lot of great work in the state around social and recreational opportunities, resources. One of the things that I've been saying, I've been in my position about a year and a half, is that Connecticut is very resource-rich in a lot of ways, but the resources aren't necessarily connected. We have pockets of excellence all over the state, really, and state-of-the-art activities and things happening, but they're not connected, and they can be really difficult for families to navigate the system. So So I would really encourage everyone's participation, and I just thought that it was a good thing for people to know about.
Well, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. I'm wondering, Dr. Molteni, if you can talk a little bit about the connection of services. She says there's an awful lot out there, but maybe it's not as well tied together as it could be.
Yeah, that's very true, and thank you, Jennifer, for calling in. Part of the work that's actually started prior to the development of the Advisory Council was the Autism Feasibility Study, and really the purpose of that work group and study was to look at what services are available, where are there sort of holes or gaps in services, and what are the next steps. And what the study found for Connecticut was that there are these pockets of excellence in terms of where services are provided, but there are also significant gaps in terms of those that may be covered by insurance or Medicaid. We have 169 towns in Connecticut, and so we're talking about school programming that can vary from, you know, one town to another that might be right next to each other. So the Advisory Council's sort of role at this point is to start to look at how do we coordinate a lot of this, or how do we develop a statewide program, not be funded by the state, but a program that sort of coordinates and makes helps these places, these programs work together.
Well, I think healthcare systems is important, but I do want to ask about schools. If we see a rise in the number of kids with autism spectrum disorder, I'm wondering how we feel schools are prepared to deal with this, because clearly it is going to present some issues in the classroom, and are schools prepared?
We were talking about this a little bit before the show came on the air, and there is tremendous disparity in school districts. I think Dr. Molteni said, you know, there's 169 towns, and it's 169 ways to provide specialty services within the school districts. And, you know, that's a really significant issue, because you may get different care if you live in town A versus town B, C, or D, or urban center A. And I think that's what's concerning, and trying to find better connections between these services. And there's often not enough. I mean, right, DDS has done a great thing by including this autism waiver. So now they're willing to take in and provide services to individuals that don't have the intellectual disability component but do qualify under an autism spectrum diagnosis. But there's not enough slots for individuals to get some of those services. So it's really looking at, you know, where are the pockets of excellence? Where are we doing a great job providing services to these individuals? And where are these individuals really falling off the map?
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons why I went to the University of St. Joseph was to start to develop training programs, because not only is it a lack of services, you just don't have people mm-hmm. who are able to do this kind of work. So when we developed our graduate certificates in autism spectrum disorders and applied behavior analysis, and now our master's in autism and behavior analysis, what we're really looking to do is help provide the practitioners who can go out there and do this kind of work, both within schools and community-based settings. And in the 5 years that I've been there, we've graduated over 100 individuals at various professions to go out and do this kind of work, but there's still more to be done.
As we talk about autism here in the program, we're going to take your calls in just one moment at 860-275-7266. You mentioned urban school districts. Can you just talk about how things are different for kids in city schools as opposed to those in the suburbs or rural areas?
Well, what I've seen from, again, with the work that I do both in school consultation but also in at the Hospital for Special Care, the Autism Center, is that we're seeing that the urban centers are stretched. You know, there are fairly high concentrations of children, and in their ability to allocate the resources that are necessary to do the types of skill training and adaptive living skill programming and speech and language therapy and the types of related services these students need is very challenged. And again, the children who generally fall off are the ones that are more verbal and are more academically capable and may sort of seen as being, well, you're not engaging in challenging behavior, so you're okay, and will sort of be let go to the point where they do fall apart and end up in more significant need as far as their behavioral challenges.
Maybe you can describe for us a little bit about the disparities in autism diagnosis and treatment for different racial and ethnic groups. This is something that, as we've talked about in the past, we haven't really spent that much time talking about. I know recently that you held a forum, the Autism Multicultural Project, Addressing Disparities and Needs in Underserved Communities. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that and what we know.
Sure. Well, the Autism Multicultural Project came out of the work of Grace Clark, who's an employee at the University of St. Joseph, but it's her organization, and she really put together this forum, which we sponsored in order to present what are those disparities. And it was quite successful in terms of bringing people from a number of different states. But the focus was, what are the disparities in terms of diagnosis? You know, how do we access these services, and why is this there this problem? And, you know, a lot of it is financial. We know that for a long time, and currently Medicaid was not supporting any of the home-based services or the ones that are recommended now through insurance mandate through the state. And there were also not providers doing diagnostic evaluations for children who are on Medicaid, or there are very few of them. And so one of the things that we saw when we started the Autism Center 2.5 years ago was one community health center in New Britain sent us 44 referrals. And this was a backlog of about 2 years' worth of evaluations that they needed to have done but couldn't get done. So we see predominantly individuals with Medicaid, and we see a very diverse group of students. But there are pockets, again, of where we're seeing them. And we're trying to catch up. But the other part of that is it's not funded to a level that would allow us to support a long-term center. We're doing the work because it needs to be done, but financially it's not a really viable system.
Are there cultural barriers, whether with the Latino community or the African-American community, that maybe you can address here a little bit for us?
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, one of the things that is interesting about this CDC report is, you know, it talks about 1 in 63 white children were identified with autism spectrum, 1 in 81 black children, 1 in 93 Hispanic children. It's not that we see, you know, it's not that there is such greater prevalence in the white or Caucasian community. There is, you know, we're not as good at diagnosing, and there are, you know, several layers. There's cultural barriers. Individuals, you know, feel a sense of blame. I mean, the Institute of Living has, you know, started this whole anti-stigma campaign over the last year. And the issue with stigma, and stigma is that assumed negative belief. So if my child's diagnosed with something in the mental health spectrum or behavioral health spectrum, I must be to blame. So the more we can decrease stigma and take away that blame, the better we can provide access to treatment. So if there isn't some stigma about the fact that my child may have autism spectrum, in the same way that there shouldn't be stigma that your child's diagnosed with diabetes. You know, if we can decrease stigma, we can help people realize that it's okay to identify this, and therefore it's okay to get help for it.
I want to get to some phone calls here at 860-275-7266. If you have thoughts about autism spectrum disorder, we'd love to hear from you. Andy is in Hamden. Hello, Andy. You're on Where We Live.
Oh, hi. Thanks very much. I'm the mom of two kids. And I just wanted to push further about this question of what these higher prevalence rates mean. And I'm taking sort of two facts here. One is that we have this higher prevalence, especially at the higher end of the spectrum, at the, you know, high end of the autism spectrum. And also, when I look at my kids' classrooms, they have, you know, these classrooms in which a large percentage of kids now have some diagnosis, whether it be, you know, autism spectrum or ADHD or some other kind of related behavioral or communication problem. And it makes me wonder whether or not we're moving into an era where we're tending to diagnose things or to over-diagnose things that are actually a part of the normal variation of the human condition. And I wonder about, and I feel concerned about, the schools and the way that they've changed and the way that the demands on the kids have changed in a way that maybe is pushing these diagnoses to become more prevalent for reasons other than environmental changes.
Andy, I think, first of all, thank you very much for the phone call. And I think you expressed that very well, that normal variation in the human condition. This is something we've talked about a lot when we talked about broader issues of mental health, for instance, and stigma. And many people will ask, I mean, is it just that this is me and this is what my life is supposed to be like, and putting me on a spectrum does add to stigma? It maybe means that we're giving services that we don't need. What do you say to Andy's question? I'll ask you first, Laura, and then I also like to hear from Sean.
I too thought it was an extremely well-worded question, and I had two sort of thoughts on it. First of all, I think teachers are an amazing resource for understanding typical and atypical development, because when you get some experienced teachers, they see year after year, okay, these behaviors are really within the range of typical. They may be a little bit one end or the other, but they're within the range of typical. And then what behaviors or emotional issues really fall well outside that range. So I think we are, as we said, getting better at understanding what's typical and what's really far outside the range of typical. My second thought is it can only help our educational system to be a little bit more individualized, that to take a cookie-cutter approach to anyone. I mean, so even someone that falls within a typical range, you know, someone within that typical range, someone may be a little bit better at English, someone may be a little bit better at math, but you know, they may need a little bit of support. Even within that typical range, they're not so good at English. What can we do to improve their reading abilities? So the more individualized we get within our educational system, I only see benefits in that. I understand there's costs associated to it, but there's only benefits to make things more individualized.
But I think that this idea of impairments that you raised earlier is, I think the important one. There's atypical behavior, and then there's atypical behavior that causes some impairment in just functioning, school functioning, life functioning. And isn't that really where the marker for a diagnosis needs to be, that your life is in some way impaired? You can't do what needs to be done, frankly.
Right. Hindering functioning is kind of the guideline. So if your deficit, if the skills that you have do not allow you to function within a classroom, because that's really, the majority of a child's life is spent in school. It's that classroom functioning and all the socialization and communication that are entailed in that. Are they able to function within a classroom? Do they need additional support to make the academic gains that we expect? Yeah, we throw tons of testing at kids nowadays, much more so than we did 20 or 30 years ago. So they're catching a lot of kids that are falling off of that spectrum. Therefore, if they're falling off of the spectrum, if they're not on grade level, which is, you know, a basic marker, if they're not on grade level, then something's going wrong. And what do we need to do to provide intervention?
John, I'd love for you to pick up on this and give me some thoughts on Andy's question, our caller.
Yeah, no, it was a great question. And, you know, there are certainly increased demands overall in terms of academics and social demands over time. That we really need to be aware of. And I do think ultimately it does become a training issue. You know, there's a lot of folks who are quick to pull the trigger and say, all right, this is a problem, or your child has a problem. And I think the part that we sort of miss is that once, you know, you get a diagnosis, then it sort of becomes internal to the person. And then we sort of say, okay, well, we figured it out now, so it's not our problem. And ultimately, there is still a tremendous environmental piece that goes into interventions, because what we can change is the environment around the individual. And so when we think about or when we talk about what are the things in schools that we should be doing, well, there are lots of models already out there. There's a response to intervention model for students for any child who's not responding to the general ed curriculum. There's positive behavior interventions and supports. There's universal design for learning, where if we design it for the child with the most significant needs, everybody benefits. And so in differentiated instruction, so that, again, going back to Laura's point, you know, we have kids who this child's really good in reading, but maybe not so strong in math. And so and they may be in the high reading group and the middle math group. And that's okay, because you're sort of getting the instruction that you need, co-teaching in classrooms where you're bringing in a special educator and a regular educator together. I mean, these are all fantastic models that exist. Again, they're not always implemented, but can really benefit an entire classroom and not just the individual. And you might see gains at that point. Again, not necessarily to the level that might take away a diagnosis. And we are very cautious when we get to that level of diagnosis. We do ask for school feedback. We do send forms to the school. We'll talk to a school. So we don't just take one perspective. We take everybody's and sort of answer the question of what does this really look like across all these different settings.
We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266 as we talk about autism spectrum disorder. Jane is calling from West Hartford. Hello, Jane. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for doing this show on this very important topic. My name is Jane Thierfeld Brown, and I work with college students with autism spectrum disorders, and I've been doing that for about 15 years. And I work with students around the country through a group called College Autism Spectrum. And my concern is that there's much more work going on in other places around the country than there is in Connecticut. And I would love to have your speakers address the idea of why most of our services in the state are concentrated on children and not adults. I'm also the parent of a severely autistic 22-year-old who had great services going through school, but now that he's an adult, it feels like we've fallen off a cliff.
Jane, before I actually put this to our panelists, I'm wondering, could you describe what the better services that other states provide would look like for your child?
Sure. In other states, for the higher functioning students, in other states, my team and I, it's mandatory that we start meeting with families in eighth grade to talk about what life might look like as an adult. Because for our people on the autism spectrum, they're adults for hopefully 60 or 80 years because their lifespan is not affected by autism spectrum disorders. But they're children for about 21 years. And though we know, as both Dr. Molteni and Dr. Saunders have addressed very eloquently, it's very important to do early intervention for lifelong results. However, if we're doing that for 21 years and then everything stops in Connecticut, how do our citizens have productive adult lives?
Jane, thank you very much for the question.
Well, hi, Jane. The issue really becomes one of eligibility, you know, versus entitlement, and that's really the difference between early school-based interventions or early interventions, birth to three. Those are all part of IDEA. And then you get post-secondary transition, anything beyond 21 is you're eligible for. And, you know, the question is, we do have now, as Laura pointed out and as Jen pointed out when she called in, we do have now these services for individuals without an intellectual disability, but it's very, very limited. And now you're seeing a lot of, again, talking about college and career readiness with the Common Core, a lot of our kids aren't ready for college or career. Once they get out, they haven't developed the adaptive skills, the social skills, the types of daily living skills they need to sort of function within the community.
To be fair, what we're getting reports of, though, is that an awful lot of kids who fall outside the autism spectrum aren't ready for college either. They're not prepared either. And maybe it gets back to what one of our earlier callers was talking about. We seem to be dealing with these issues in part by diagnosing an awful lot more people on the autism spectrum disorder. In terms of problems in school, mm-hmm. There's an awful lot of people having problems in school. There's an awful lot of people whose parents are seeking some sort of special services from high schools, say, and going into early adulthood that don't fall in the autism spectrum disorder. This is a very real reality here. So I guess I'm just wondering, I'd love your thoughts, too, on this.
Well, I think that what's so important about what Jane's bringing up here is that as we're talking about a spectrum disorder, where it's a, you know, it, that other spectrum is that developmental spectrum. And yes, you know, adulthood is the great, you know, percentage of how long we live. And I do think that, you know, that's why so many of these resource groups are so critical in getting families connected to Autism Helps or some of the other resource groups out there. So many parents don't know to make links in education and advocacy, that the better educated they are, the stronger advocates they can be for their children, because they're, you know, whether your child is 5 or 15 or 25, they're still your child. And parents in these situations very often need to stay involved for the entire developmental spectrum for these individuals. So getting access to information improves their ability to be advocates for their children.
Just very quickly before our break, we've mentioned a couple times this change in rules that allows for those without developmental disabilities but who are on the autism spectrum to receive some of these state-level services. Mm-hmm. So the question is, does this have the unintended poor consequence of starving the entire system? It already seems as though there's not enough money to go around to serve everyone. Does this cause a bigger problem down the road?
No.
You don't think
so? The short answer is no. If I understand correctly, and maybe someone can call back and correct me, is that the funding stream of this is the Medicaid waiver is something that is, I believe, is funded differently. From a different stream. It came from a different place initially, and that's why there's only so many spots for it. if that funding increased there. So we're not taking out of the pie that already exists. It's a new piece of the pie, but it's still a very small piece.
I just want to make sure I understood it as much as I could, because that is a change. And, mm-hmm. and whenever we're talking about money for services, you know, we talk about this an awful lot on the show. That's always an issue, and where the money's going to come from. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation as we look at autism spectrum disorder on the show with Dr. John Maltenny from the University of St. Joseph, Dr. Laura Saunders from the Institute of Living, and with you here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we're just about halfway through this year, so it's time for our regular music check-in with Anthony Fantano. He's the host of the very popular music blog and YouTube channel, The Needle Drop. He'll swing by to share some of his favorite music of the year so far, and we'll preview the Connecticut Music Awards, talk about some of the great local bands out there with Chip McCabe. Hope you can join our musical conversation tomorrow. Today, we're talking about autism spectrum disorder with Dr. John Maltenny from the University of St. Joseph and Dr. Laura Saunders, who's a psychologist at the Institute of Living. Quickly, I want to go to Shamar, who's calling from New Britain. Hi, Shamar. Go ahead.
Hi. I also work for DBS, and I took a small documentary class about autism, and I did a study on how different states compare to Connecticut. And there's this one story I did where this family moved from Alabama to Connecticut just for Connecticut services, and this was back in the 70s. Sad to say, the person that I did the study on passed away, but the mom raved about the service that Connecticut offered. Matter of fact, they came up from Alabama, and they went to Thornton Children's Hospital where they got their service, and this was back in the 70s.
Hmm. Shamar, thank you for sharing that story. I appreciate it. It actually leads us into our next guest, who's calling in, Ann Holmes, who's chairperson of the panel of professional advisors for the Autism Society of America, to broaden out our spectrum a little bit. And Ann, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering if you can address a little bit of Shamar's question right there. How much is there variability of services across this country?
He brought up a great point. There is an incredible amount of variability, and it is true. Many families call the states that tend to have better services for individuals with autism, and they do move. I know I live in New Jersey, and I know New York, Connecticut are very, very popular states for parents to move to because they are desperate for services. So the variability is great.
From your perspective, how well prepared are we as a nation to address this increase in the number of kids diagnosed with autism?
I'm a glass half full person, so I want to think we're aware. So awareness is the beginning of being prepared. I think the awareness has not only impacted focus on research into cause, but really looking at how we're going to serve people with autism and their families now. I think besides the variability in the states, the emphasis on early diagnosis so we can get early intervention in is critical for the level of service an individual needs throughout their life.
I'm wondering if you can address this question we raised earlier about how many kids may be indeed falling through the cracks, whether they're in low-income communities, maybe they wouldn't be as readily diagnosed. How many kids in America do you think that we're missing, even with these statistics increasing all the time? I'm sure that there are still many falling through the cracks.
Yes, and your point's well taken. And even prior to the change in the diagnosis, there are kids that are falling through the cracks because of cultural issues, economic issues. I haven't seen as big of a push to get into those communities and those families to help with that early diagnosis. So I think that is a problem. And I don't necessarily think the change in the diagnosis is impacting that. I think it's an area of deficit that we need to look at.
When parents are concerned, one of the things they may do is look up services, and they may stumble across the Autism Society of America. Can you talk a little bit about the work that you do, just so that people might understand what help you might be able to provide?
Yes, I think there's two things about the Autism Society that I think are of value to families. One is that it does have a nationwide perspective, a national perspective, and a lot of work going on in Capitol Hill in terms of of laws and regulations, et cetera. So they have the Autism Society has their pulse on that. What I've been drawn to the Autism Society for probably 30 years is that it's a grassroots organization in that it supports its affiliates. So the Autism Society has affiliates in almost all states so that parents can, on the local level, get that referral. The other guest on your show was talking about that need for parents to be connected and educated and feel that community. That's what the Autism Society is really pushing, is getting parents connected at the local level.
Ann Holmes is chairperson of the panel of professional advisors for the Autism Society of America. She joined us by phone today. Ann, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks.
We just have a few minutes left, and I'm wondering if I can ask our guests to maybe talk a little bit about that. For parents who are seeking some sort of information, want to be just a little bit better informed about this, Dr. Saunders, maybe you can talk about this first, because I think this is a very important piece.
Yeah, I love what Ann said from the Autism Society. She talked about awareness and preparedness, because awareness and preparedness lead to better advocacy. And that's really the key. I mean, we as professionals do things to, you know, stay on top of the research and educate ourselves so that we can be experts and advocates in our area. The same thing needs to happen for parents. The more we can get them connected to some of these local and nationally based organizations, the better information they can get, and that information leads directly to their ability to advocate for their child's needs, because the reality is schools don't jump out and offer tons of services to kids without someone advocating for them.
In part because it's very expensive, right?
Absolutely.
And I think this is something we've seen in a number of school districts. How about you, Dr. Maltani? What are some of your thoughts about this?
Yeah, parent connections are real important. It's one of the subcommittees on the Autism Spectrum Disorder Advisory Council is working on how do we disseminate these resources more effectively. So through 211 and the Autism Spectrum Resource Center.
And through 211, you mean the hotline 211 that provides a number of connections to state services.
Correct.
But please continue. Yeah.
Correct. And then in multiple languages again. So we're looking at how do we do these get people access to these resources when they're not readily in one centralized place, and that's from a statewide perspective. So, you know, these do become critical. It's one of the bigger issues when you talk about advocacy, and you have we were talking about this on Tuesday at the forum at St. Joe's about the Autism Speaks and their 180-day kit and those types of things. And the kits are great, and the information is great, except when it doesn't work the way it says so in the book, because not everybody's read the book. And so when you say, do this, go to the school, go to this, and they go to the school and the school says no, or they go to the healthcare provider, the insurance company says no, then what? And then that's where you need, so as Laura's pointing out, you need the parents, you need the advocates, you need the people who know how to navigate when someone says no.
We have just about a minute and a half here left. Is there anything we've left out on this conversation? Because there may be a number of things that people might want to ask us that they've been maybe too scared to ask, in part because of stigma or anything else. What are some thoughts you might want to leave parents with who are listening right now?
I mean, our mantra is early intervention. The earlier we can intervene and get access to treatment and have parents be advocates, the better the long-term outcomes are. That's the bottom line.
I would say we need more professionals, more trained professionals out there in all fields to sort of address the needs of this population. We need more research on interventions. There's a lot of research being done on cause, and intervention is necessary. And the work that we're now doing, we're starting to develop the Center for Applied Research and Education at St. Joe's, where we're looking to evaluate intervention, and because that's the key. Once you know the diagnosis, what is the next step?
We got one caller who didn't want to go on air but had a question about services for adults with autism spectrum disorders. We talked about teens and those maybe transitioning out above 21, but there are many people who are living in their 30s and 40s and beyond with autism spectrum disorders. What do we know about services available to them quickly, if you don't mind?
Yeah, it's primarily through the Department of Developmental Services. Again, if you have an intellectual disability, that's the primary place. If you don't have the intellectual disability, the autism division would be the one to contact, and then they coordinate some job coaching, community mentors, and those types of programmatic supports.
Dr. John Maltani from the University of St. Joseph, the Autism and Behavioral Studies Program there, thank you so much for your help.
Thanks
also to Dr. Laura Saunders, who's a psychologist at the Institute of Living. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.